Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star 1 on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Tara, and good morning, everyone, and thank you for participating in this call where NOAA and NASA scientists will discuss the data from the 2017 global temperature record and other climate highlights from the year. Again, I'm Brady Phillips, Public Affairs Officer with NOAA's Office of Communications, and I'll be managing the call today. So NOAA and NASA are two keepers of the world's climate data and independently produce a record of Earth's surface temperatures, as well as changes to those temperatures based on historical observations over our oceans and land. Consistency between these two independent analyses and those analyses produced by science agencies in other countries, such as the UK Met Service and others, increase our confidence in the accuracy of such data, the assessments of the data, and resulting conclusions. These analyses provide governments and businesses with critical decision-making information. During the call today, we'll feature two short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. During the call, we'll be speaking to a PowerPoint presentation that can be downloaded from the web at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. It can also be downloaded from NASA at nasa.gov/media resources. In addition, this call is being streamed live by NASA at nasa.gov/NASA Live. Our first presenter is Gavin Schmidt, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, who will summarize NASA's 2017 average global temperature data for 2017. Our next presenter will be Deke Arndt, the chief of the monitoring section at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville, North Carolina. We'll provide a summary of NOAA's 2017 global temperature and climate data for the year. So we'll begin with Gavin from NASA. Gavin?
Thank you very much, Brady. I'm going to move directly to slide 2, entitled NASA's 2017 Global Temperatures. What you can see there is a map of the anomaly for 2017 with respect to a baseline which should read 1951 to 1980. I'm not quite sure why it doesn't. And the anomalies there are in Fahrenheit, but there's an equivalent scale in centigrade. The bottom line is that 2017 was the second warmest year in the NASA GISTEMP record, only less than 2016, the winner last year, so to speak. The current temperatures are about 0.9 degrees Celsius, 1.6 Fahrenheit, above the 1951-1980 baseline, and that translates to about 1.1 degrees Celsius, or just under 2 degrees Fahrenheit, just over 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than the late 19th century. As you can see from the map, warmth is pervasive across the planet. You're seeing warmer temperatures still over land, warmest temperatures overall in the Arctic, but you can see that the warmth is spread pretty uniformly. There's only a few places where there's been a net cooling. There was a net cool period last year, mainly in the Southern Ocean and in the North Atlantic and North Pacific. But apart from that, the planet is warming remarkably uniformly. Over to you, Deke.
Thanks, Gavin. So I'm speaking now to slide 3, NOAA's 2017 global temperature. For the NOAA record, it was the third warmest year of the record. It was about 1.5 degrees above the 20th century average. This map on this slide shows our temperature analysis very much the same way that the NASA map shows. So these are departures from a base period. This happens to be departures from a slightly warmer base period, but you can see the same general patterns throughout the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere, particularly the strongly above average temperatures in North America and parts of Asia, particularly Siberia. You can also see that our analysis does not extend into the Arctic as the NASA one does, which may explain or very likely explain some of the subtle differences in our analysis for this particular year. On the left and right of the map, we just have some general statistics regarding different parts of the world to point out that neutral to La Nina conditions prevailed most of the year. Gavin's going to touch on this a little later in the presentation, but it was, again, the third warmest year on our record. 2015, 16, and 17 now represent the three warmest years on our record. Moving to slide four, this shows the time series of that same data. Each dot on this time series represents an annual average temperature, 1880 on the left through 2017 on the right. The dark line represents the 1951 through 80 average temperature, a base period we're sharing with NASA for this presentation. So years that are above that line were warmer than that average during that base period. Years that are below that dark line were cooler than that average. You can clearly see long-term warming. We have also shaded each decade's average, so the average of the 10 years in that decade are the pink bars in this graphic. You can see where 2017 fits in our record, third warmest year on record, clearly among the three warmest years on our record. And again, as in the past versions of this joint conference, the annual change from year to year can bounce up and down. There is year-to-year variability, but the long-term trends are very clear, especially since the mid-20th century. With that, I'll hand it back to Gavin.
Thank you, Deke. Moving on to slide five, this is the equivalence data set for the NASA GISS temp analysis, and you can see the 2017 kind of just pips out 2015 in our analysis, but the overall picture is very, very similar and coherent. We are in a long-term warming trend despite the ups and downs that you sometimes get on an annual basis or even a decadal basis. The decadal averages really show a much clearer pattern of what's going on in the climate, not just in the weather. And as you can see, that's that growth, even in the last decade compared to all the others, is substantial. Deke.
Yes, so moving to slide six, I mentioned earlier that this was an ENSO neutral to La Nina year. ENSO, El Nino, La Nina. The El Niño-La Niña phenomena are captured in a concept called the El Niño-Southern Oscillation, or ENSO for short. It basically describes an ocean atmosphere pattern largely over the Pacific that can influence global temperatures in addition to a lot of regional weather outcomes during a year. But it does have an impact on global temperature. El Niño periods tend to increase global temperature with a lot more heat being released into the atmosphere. La Nina episodes tend to cool the global temperature. So what this graphic shows is zoomed in since 1980 on the left, January 1980 through December 2017, a monthly look at NOAA's data set. And we're just providing this to show that if you look at the red months, these are months in which El Nino was active. They tend to be warmer during these El Nino episodes than their immediate neighbors. They tend to warm during the course of an El Nino event. When you look at just the La Nina, the blue months, they tend to be cooler than the times around them, and they tend to cool off during the stronger La Nina events. This is to basically illustrate a concept. Gavin has done some analysis, and he's going to speak to that in the following slide of kind of the the results when you account for the effects of El Nino, and I'll hand off to Gavin for slide 7.
Yeah, we're on slide 7. So one of the things that you can do, given that we understand that the phase of El Nino or La Nina influences the annual mean temperature, but we know that it's also a natural pattern. So we can try and statistically extract that from the record and get a sense of what the long-term changes are in the record that aren't associated with these interannual patterns. And so we can do that by looking at the correlation of the annual mean to, you know, the INTO indices, and this is a relatively crude way of doing it, but basically we're just regressing out the connection to the El Nino index at the beginning of the year. It doesn't really matter which months you use. And what you can see is that it does smooth the temperature record a little bit because it's taking out some of that interannual variability. And you can see, for instance, that where we had big El Nino events, it's kind of brought the index down, and where we had big La Nina events, cool periods, it's kind of brought the index up. And so you can see both, I think, a little bit more clearly where we've had big volcanoes in the records since 1950. The three ones are marked on the graph, but you can also see that if you remove the effect of ENSO, what would have happened is that 2014, 2015, 2016, and 2017 all would have been record warm years in that kind of idealized scenario. And so this kind of analysis really brings it home that the warmth that we're seeing and the trends that we're seeing are independent of this variation in the Pacific. And while the ins and outs of any particular year are affected by it, it's the long-term trend that's really pushing these numbers up. And that's continuing independently of anything that's happening in terms of interannual variability in the Pacific. We can make a very specific calculation of the El Nino contribution in various years. You can see that there was a contribution in 2015, a larger contribution in 2016, but because of last year being relatively INTO neutral, there isn't actually much contribution there at all. And so you're seeing really, you know, the long-term trend that's independent of El Nino. If we move now to slide 8, you can see a comparison of the two data sets that we've been discussing here, the NASA GISTEMP data set and the NOAA data set, in comparison with three other data sets, one from the Met Office and the Climatic Research Units in the UK, and then two non-governmental efforts, one that's run by the Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature Project from Berkeley University, and another independent one from two researchers called Cowton and Way, Kevin Cowton and Michael Way, who have both worked on trying to improve the coverage of the high latitudes in their data sets. The details of the analyses are, they differ in small details, but the overall picture is very, very clear and coherent. You do get a little variation in one year or another, but the long-term trends, and that's the important thing for attribution of these changes, are all very clear and independent of whoever is doing these analyses. That's a very important point. Okay, over to Deek for the next one.
So the next few slides will be looking at different pieces of the climate system. We focus on the global surface temperature in the first part of this briefing because that is something we measure fairly well, and it's something we experience directly. But the climate system is complex. There's many pieces to it. The additional energy that's trapped by greenhouse gases kind of manifests and expresses itself in different ways throughout the climate system, and especially from year to year. So very briefly on the next few slides, we'll be looking at different pieces of the climate system and how they have played out. So on slide 9, looking at basically layers of the atmosphere, so the three graphics that you see on the right hand of the slide refer to the first three bullets or collections of bullets on the left. So kind of working down from higher in the atmosphere as you go from top to bottom on this slide, the lower stratosphere had, again, another year that was cooler than the long-term average. The middle troposphere, for the purposes of this briefing, is essentially the next layer down that is observed via satellite, was warm. And then the lower troposphere, the lowest slab of the atmosphere, up to about 25,000 feet, was either the third or the fourth warmest, depending on the satellite analysis. And these come from our partners at the Remote Sensing Systems, the University of Alabama, Huntsville, and the STAR Group within NOAA and NESDES. Again, moving on to the next slide, slide number 10, upper ocean heat content. So the vast majority of the additional heat that's trapped in the climate system ends up in the ocean, particularly the upper ocean, the part that's in contact with the atmosphere. And so this is one of several analyses of global upper ocean heat content. This comes from our Centers for Coast, Oceans, and Geophysics here within NCEI. There will be other data sets that trickle out over the next few months, but their analysis showed that the heat content in this layer of the ocean was indeed the largest on their record, which extends back a little more than 60 years. This is an estimate of basically how much energy is in or being added to this slab of the ocean. You can, the units are zettajoules. You can think of them as very large quantities of energy. But again, the yearly average based on this first of several data sets coming out in the upper ocean was the largest on the record. The next slide shows Arctic sea ice extent since 1979, the dawn of the satellite observation era. The red line shows the average value during September, which is the time of the year when Arctic sea ice retreats to a minimum. The blue line shows the value for March, which is the time of year typically when the Arctic sea ice footprint expands to its maximum. You can see that both times of year are decreasing. The September value, when the footprint is smallest, is decreasing more. These are percentages of the average value. This is important because the sea ice during times of high sun, during the season when the sun is higher in the sky, the absence of sea ice means that less sunlight is reflected back away from the surface, and this tends to add to the heating already underway. We call this a positive feedback in the climate system. As more ice and snow goes away, less sunlight is reflected, and it tends to be an additive factor to warming. The inset in this shows the high latitudes in the northern hemisphere taken from the GISTEMP, the NASA temperature analysis. You can see that the Arctic is warming much faster. The Arctic in black is warming much faster than the global average in red in the inset. And these two are related. As Arctic sea ice continues to retreat, especially during the high sun season, we will continue to see the Arctic in general warm faster than the rest of the planet. Look, the next slide, number 12, looks at Arctic sea ice day by day. This is just to provide some statistics on how that evolved over the year. The red line shows the daily sea ice extent in the Arctic during 2017. The black line on this graphic shows the average from 1981 through 2010. You can see every day during the year, the 2017 value was significantly below the average. And then we've provided some monthly statistics. Again, July, August, September, those are times when the sun is fairly high in the sky, June as well. That much, quote-unquote, missing sea ice, again, contributes to that additional effect where less sunlight is being reflected into the away from the surface. The next slide, slide 13, shows the same for the Antarctic. In late 2016, after a couple years of very large sea ice values in the Antarctic, the sea ice extent went back towards the small side of history and kind of remained there throughout 2017. And then finally, on slide 14, northern hemisphere snow cover extent. We measure northern hemisphere snow cover extent. The northern hemisphere is where the vast, vast majority of all of the seasonal snow cover is in the planet. So it's, again, you can see on the graph on the right, this shows the rate of decline in percentage per decade for each month of the year, beginning with July on the left, through the peak of the snow season in the middle, and then June again on the right, so July through June being the kind of snow calendar. You can see that the trends tend to be the blue bars extending downward. Those months are seeing more rapid decline in snow cover over time. Again, also a contributor to this additive feedback. And with that, I will stop our prepared presentation and hand it back, I believe, to Brady for Q&A.
Thank you both, Deke and Gavin. We will now take specific questions from the participants. And if you know who you want to answer the question, please indicate if you want Deke or Gavin, or if you don't know, we'll have them decide who's going to answer it. Tara, can you remind folks how they can ask a question, and please queue up the first call. Thank you.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It will take a few moments for the questions to come through. Please stand by. The first question comes from Seth from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I guess probably Gavin, but Deke, if you want to jump in here. Looking at your slide, when you're talking about 0.12 of the 2016 heat being attributable to El Nino, that contribution, and zero now. Does that mean basically if you took out El Nino, since using NASA data, the difference is about 0.09, that if you took out El Nino, 2016 and 2017 would be virtually the same? And the second part of this is it fair to say because 2017 doesn't have the confounding factor of an El Nino, that this is even more of a clear signal of anthropogenic climate change than a year that has an El Nino natural heating in there?
Thanks, Seth. Actually, as you can see on the on that slide directly, 2017 would still have been significantly warmer than 2016 without the El Nino effect. But obviously, they're closer together, and so you know the chances that say a difference in analysis or a difference in data source might have an impact is slightly larger. I haven't done that specific calculation for you.
I'm confused. You said 2017 would still be larger than 2016, but 2016 is actually larger. So I mean, that's
right.
Why I'm a little confused. So without El Nino. Which
there's,
is
there's two lines on the graph on that slide, right? The black line is the is our actual analysis, and then the red line is the analysis with the El Nino signal removed. And you can see that 2017, it would in the analysis with ENSO removed, would have been the warmest year. It is not the warmest year; it's the second warmest year in the analysis that obviously did have El Nino in it.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So to respond to your second question, does a year when it's ENSO neutral, being again a very, very warm year, help with the attribution of the long-term trends to greenhouse gases or to other factors? The answer is a little bit, not really. I mean, you can always have taken the El Niño years and the La Niña years, and you've been able to see that the trends in both of those sets of years have been equal and up, though slightly offset. But the attribution work that you do tries to take into account the interannual variability that you just normally expect. And so our attributions for the long-term trends that we've seen, which are to, 100% to greenhouse gases increasing, are pretty much unaffected by, the year-to-year variations in El Niño. It's perhaps a little bit easier to clarify. Okay. maybe it's a little bit easier to clarify these things when there isn't an El Niño involved. But the planet is warming regardless of what's going on in the tropical Pacific.
Oh, thank you.
The next question comes from Doyle Rice of USA Today. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing this. A couple questions about the NASA data. Why do you use the 1951 to 1980 as the baseline, and why does NOAA use the entire 20th century? And what's the rationale for those differences?
This is Gavin Schmidt. When NASA started making this analysis, it started in the early 80s, and the climate normal period then, there was the most recent 30-year spread, which was 1951 to 1980. Because our interest has mainly been in tracking climate change over time, we haven't changed that baseline so that we've been able to stay consistent over time. Now, Deke might be able to chime in here, but NOAA has and WMO have a slightly different reason for the baselines that they use. They want to keep their baselines current, and so they move them around. But their choice of the 20th century as their main baseline, as opposed to the mid 20th century, it actually doesn't make that much difference. It's less than 0.1 of a degree, but I think it's mainly historical. Deke.
Sure, yes, and this is a recurring question, even within the community. It is kind of a potato-potato approach. We've chosen the 20th century for the time series presentation just because it's kind of easily accessible in people's memory banks. They don't have to do a lot of work to kind of know what the 20th century is, so it's from a service-oriented posture to trying to, and it's also something that won't move over time. Just like Gavin said, and for the purposes of long-term tracking, we want to use a fixed goalpost, a fixed reference, so that we can track over time, just like he articulated. For our maps, we actually use a more current period, 1981 to 2010, because that does enable some contrast, because people that are looking at maps are usually looking at spatial patterns, and they want to see or they're looking for places of contrast, and using a later base period, which happens to be warmer, allows for a little bit more blue on the map, to put it bluntly. It allows folks to see contrast in which regions were very warm versus which regions were neutral to cool compared to that later period. So it's basically the choices we make. And I'm speaking for Gavin here, and I hope that's okay, or basically relate to kind of what we're trying to analyze and who we're trying to serve. And we go through an exercise about this time every year where we try to reconcile our different data sets to common base periods. So the slide that Gavin showed with the five data sets on it, we've gone through the exercise of reconciling those so that people can do an apples-to-apples comparison.
Okay, just looking ahead to 2018, what do we think? I know we're now in a La Nina advisory situation. I just wonder, what does it look like, if you can forecast that? Where do we think this year might end up?
Hey, this is Deke. We don't do predictions in our shop. I would say if La Nina does play out, La Nina does tend to pull individual years down below trend, but not every El Nino or La Nina year is the same, and it's the way it affects the climate around the world, and so they're not exactly the same in how they affect the annual global temperature as well.
Gavin here. So we don't do it officially. I do have some statistical models that I use to predict what any one particular year is going to look like ahead of time. We predicted, for instance, last year that 2017 would be the second warmest year, and we predicted that a year ahead of time. Using the same kind of technique and using our understanding of what the ENSO conditions are right now, we'd be looking for quite a similar year next year as to this year. So it would be almost certainly a top 5 year. And possibly another top 2 year, depending a little bit on what happens this year. But the long-term trends are clear, and that's giving us most of that predictability going forward.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Etienne LeBlanc of Radio Canada. Your line is open. Etienne LeBlanc, your line is open.
Etienne?
Hello. Yeah, I'm sorry. I was wondering if this is in accordance to what was predicted like 10 years ago. But 10 years ago or 15 years ago, were you seeing that trend? Is it warming faster than you thought, or according to what you saw many years ago?
Gavin here, I'll take that. So trends, predictions that go out more than a few months or a year rely on climate models as opposed to weather forecasting model. And so the predictive capability there is the fact that greenhouse gases are increasing and we can say something about what the solar cycle is doing and the like. And if you go back to climate model predictions that were made, say, in the early 2000s, 2017 is almost exactly on trend for the average of those predictions. And so the answer is, yeah, we're warming up pretty much at the rate that we anticipated a decade ago.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Alistair Doyle of Reuters. Your line is open.
Thanks so much. Thanks for doing this. So, just a bit of politics, I guess. Donald Trump tweeted the other day, of course, that it was unusually cold in the United States and that other countries are wasting trillions of dollars on the Paris Climate Agreement. What do you say to people who doubt that this trend is driven primarily by greenhouse gas emissions? And do you have the IPCC said it was extremely likely, I think, that global warming is primarily driven by human activities. But what is the – do you have a percentage for that now? What's your percentage estimate that this is driven mainly by human activities, please?
Gavin here. Thank you very much for the question. NASA and NOAA work on providing the best science that we can and the best analyses that we can, and we don't really get involved in the policy aspects of this. With respect to the attribution of climate change, we have worked on this, not really part of this project, but as part of our climate modeling work. And to answer your question, and this is actually in accordance with what the IPCC said, basically all of the warming in the last 60 years is attributable to human activities, and carbon dioxide emissions are the number one component of that. there's a little bit of uncertainty there, but as IPCC said, the best estimate of the attributable warming to human activities is basically equal to the warming that we've had.
Thanks.
The next question comes from Robert Holtz. Your line is open.
Thank you, gentlemen, for walking us through this. I wonder if I may just ask you to explain in a little more depth the way in which the two groups handle data from the polar regions differently and why.
Hi.
Okay, Captain here. I'll go first.
I didn't mean to stump you. I'm sorry.
No, we could both answer that. So that was just
jumping. Good, good.
So one of the things that, that NASA relies on, or the analysis relies on, is that temperature anomalies are quite strongly correlated from one area to another. And we use that observation to try and say more about what's happening in the central Arctic and in Antarctica, given the sparsity of stations that we have there. Now, that wouldn't make much difference, except that we know that the Arctic is warming significantly faster than the rest of the planet, and there's an inset on slide 11 which just shows how much faster the warming in the Arctic is compared to the global mean. And so, if we don't interpolate through the Arctic and try and get as good an estimate there as possible, we're actually lowballing slightly the warming that we're seeing globally. And for comparison to models and things like that, that makes a difference. So the NASA analysis is really trying to maximize the amount of useful information that we can extract from the Arctic in ways that are defendable. Dee?
Sure. Not much to add. NOAA, we tend to be just a little, or we have been in recent years, just a little more on the conservative side on how deeply we reach into areas with sparse data in our data set. I'll also add that while we do use quite a few of the same stations, it's not a complete match. So I believe NASA has access to some high latitude stations that help them make that reach as well, in addition to their desire to infill over the Arctic. It's essentially, again, that is very likely the difference in what we're seeing this year, especially, and it's just two different approaches, one a little more conservative, one a little more aggressive. They help complement each other, so by examining the way, and this is not just between our two groups, but several of the groups around the world that are looking into how do we best go about this. We compare methods, we learn from each other, we tend to update our versions every few years, and it's a healthy kind of game of leapfrog on who's looking at what.
Thank you very much.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. The next question comes from Emily Atkins with The New Republic. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing this call. My question is also slightly political. The Trump administration has been accused in the past of interfering with climate change at some regulatory agencies, including avoiding the mention of the word climate change at the CDC, removing climate references from the EPA websites. I'm just wondering to what extent, if any, Have political appointees been involved in this temperature data analysis process at NASA, NOAA, and has anyone from the administration directed you to avoid the words climate change?
Hi, this is Deke. I'll start, and I'm sure Gavin will want to chime in. The analysis we conducted this year was done in the exact same way and with the exact same amount of rigor than we have in the years that I've been in my position, which is this is my ninth year. So no change from previous ways of doing this analysis.
I'd just like to second that. We've done this in exactly the same way as we've always done, and we've had no input from any political appointees throughout this process.
Hi, this is Brady. One thing I would also like to point reporters to, at the end of last year, the Climate Science Special Report, which was Volume 1 of the 4th National Climate Assessment, was released to the public. This is the scientific assessment, kind of as a the state of science as it relates to climate change. So this was a document cleared by 13 federal agencies. I'd encourage you to go on the U.S. Global Change Research Program website and download that. Also, there was a media call related to that report, and some of the scientists directly answered that question as well. And, you know, this was released, and at the time there was, you know, the administration let it be released. So I encourage you to look back at the Climate Science Special Report. Thanks. Next question.
The next question comes from Nicholas Gerbis with KJZZ News in Phoenix. Your line is open.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, I know that this is mainly temperature data that you're dealing with, but since you also touch on snow and ice, I was wondering if you could speak to any changes in precipitation patterns globally, particularly in arid regions.
Hello, this is Deke, and just a very high-level overview, and this is not the case universally, but we are generally seeing precipitation increase in the already kind of wetter areas of the world, again, with some exceptions. The places that are kind of on the wetter side of the spectrum are tending to see more precipitation, and in particular see more precipitation in larger doses. This is certainly true in the U.S. and much of Europe, where we have very dense long-term records as well. According to the National Climate Assessment, and this is focused again on the just on the U.S., the southwestern United States, the more arid part of the United States, is not seeing the increases either in precipitation or the large events as the rest of the country is. I'll stop there.
Thank you.
And I'm not seeing any other questions queued up, so I'm going to put out a last call. If you do have a question, please press star 1. And I'll give a minute just for folks to think about if they have any more questions. This is your last chance to get all those questions asked. Or follow-up questions. Okay. If not, I'm going to end. Oh, hang on. There's one more question.
Etienne LeBlanc, Radio Canada, your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much. I was wondering if I could take the chance to ask a question in French to Mr. Schmidt, since he speaks French. Would that be appropriate, or can we talk after?
Il n'y a pas de problème.
Bonjour, Monsieur Schmitt. Merci beaucoup de faire ça pour moi. Alors, si on voulait résumer là pour les auditeurs francophones, c'est que malgré l'effet El Niño, donc la planète continue de se réchauffer. Est-ce que je peux vous demander de résumer en, en une minute ce que vous avez présenté ce matin. Merci.
Oui, merci. Bon, c'est clair que l'année 2017 est encore une année très chaude, comme les autres qu'on a vues dernièrement. Les dérives de température sont clairement dans la direction de réchauffement, et ça, c'est en fonction du les gaz à effet de serre et les activités humaines qui continuent par chaque année. Ce qu'on voit la dernière année, c'était qu'on n'avait pas un événement El Niño. Alors là, ça peut ajouter un peu aux températures, mais si on voit que dernièrement, on n'a pas eu ce phénomène, donc on voit plus clairement les dérives climatiques au lieu de les variations interannuelles.
En quoi sommes-nous certains que c'est l'action de l'homme qui provoque cela?
On peut tomber dans ce qu'on peut dire les fingerprints de toutes les choses qui peuvent changer le climat. On peut regarder le fingerprint pour le soleil, pour les volcans, pour les changements sur la surface de la Terre et aussi pour les gaz à effet de serre. Et ce qu'on voit, c'est que le consilience des données, pas seulement à la surface, mais plus haut et dans la stratosphère, dans l'océan, on voit que c'est que les fingerprints des gaz à effet de serre qui enfoncent le mieux avec les données. Alors, c'est de là qu'on dérive l'attribution des changements climatiques.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much for letting me ask a question in French. Thank you very much to everybody.
Il n'y a pas de quoi. Merci.
The next question comes from Sam Dorman, the Independent Journal Review. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks again for holding this. I was just wondering if you could clarify sort of where the administration stands on global warming and the science behind it. Trump tweeted, I think, at the end of last year that we had the coldest New Year's Eve on record and that we could use a little bit more of that good old global warming that our country, but other countries, is going to pay trillions of dollars for. And I was just wondering, does NASA agree with the president's implication that a cold New Year's Eve could be helped from more global warming, or that more global warming would change the fact that it was going to be the coldest New Year's Eve on record?
Hi. Oh, sorry, Gavin, go ahead.
Oh, no, feel free.
I'm sorry?
You go ahead.
Yeah, just to reiterate Gavin's point from earlier, we assemble these analyses and perform our analysis and execute and design our science in order to inform the policy space, but we do not engage in policy activities. Our job is to seek out and find the signals of what's going on and provide that to the policy-making sphere.
Well, yes, I'm not asking so much about the policy. I'm asking about the science of whether more climate change would change the weather or whether it could be a good thing for changing the weather on New Year's Eve.
So, Gavin here. So, obviously, you know, weather doesn't go away because we have a long-term climate shift. We are going to get cold air outbreaks. We're not getting them as frequently as we used to. People are studying quite intently the extent to which the statistics of these dynamic patterns that gave rise to the very cold New Year's Eve might be shifted or might be shifting as a function of changes in the Arctic or changes in the stratosphere. My assessment of that science is that it's still pretty speculative, and so we haven't got a strong case that there's been any shift in the long term in these kind of statistics. You know, every New Year's Eve, I do a run in Central Park, and I've been doing it, you know, pretty much every year for the last 18 years. You know, Central Park temperatures in New Year's Eve, they vary a lot. And there's, like, the last 2 years were well above freezing. This year was quite cold. You know, it's a single day. There's a lot of noise in that, and it's very hard to pick out a climate change signal in such a short time period.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and with that, I'm going to end the call and remind folks that an audio of this call will be found on the NOAA Media Advisory within about 60 minutes or so. And that's if you go to NOAA.gov and look under /media-advisories, it'll be there. And if you do have further questions or need follow-up, please feel free to email me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. That's brady.phillips. Or my colleague, Leslie McCarthy, at NASA GIS, and her email is leslie.m.mccarthy@nasa.gov. So this concludes the call. Thank you very much.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.